Wendy?
Yes, Lisa.
Is the water warm enough?
Yes, Lisa.
Shall we begin?
Yes, Lisa.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Dance Music Sex Romance Podcast. I'm your host, Zachary Hoskins, and today I am talking to Carmen Hoover, another attendee, another presenter at the University of Salford Purple Rain Conference. Carmen, I'm actually going to let her introduce herself this time, but she is not only a scholar, but was one of those people who were there. She's the first person I've interviewed to have actually breathed the same air as Prince. So you can hear me try and contain my excitement and try to ask her questions about Salford when what I really want to know is, like, you know, what was he like? So I hope you enjoy this conversation. I certainly did. And I definitely hope that I can get Carmen back so I can pester her with questions about Prince and Minneapolis in the 80s. Please enjoy.
Well, I'm a college instructor now. I teach at a community college in Western Washington in the United States. Mm-hmm. It's in a small former logging town. I'm the only English faculty at the satellite where I teach.
Oh, wow.
So that's kind of my work life. I'm in a teeny tiny little lab, and I teach mostly writing classes, so from developmental, the low 90s in our structure, and then on to, you know, the cornerstone English 101, and then also advanced composition argumentation. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of my main push in my job. I also teach some film class. I teach the history of rock and roll once a year.
Oh, great. Yeah.
and then I teach native lit and creative writing. So I have quite a few preps and, you know, do quite a few things because I'm the only full-timer.
Yeah.
I teach English where I am. But, like, for instance, this history of rock and roll class, it really has allowed me to stay current with music and kind of have an excuse to, I bring live acts into the class.
Oh, wow.
So we go through the whole history of rock and roll, kind of starting around the Civil War, just talking about instrumentation and things like that, leading up through jazz and, you know, Jim Crow and civil rights, and kind of do all of that as a, you know, I'm teaching it as a social history pretty much. And then towards the end of every quarter for that class, I try to bring in a singer-songwriter, a hip-hop act, and a rock and roll or country or blues band. So, you know, I still have this music activity in my life as well, and try to see a lot of live music. But of course, you know, what was really interesting to me about the conference, and you know, I thought the conference was amazing. We'll talk about it. one of Prince's former bodyguards, who I'm still friends with, posted about this conference, and I just thought, I have to find a way to be there. Mm-hmm. I was an early Prince fan, moved to Minneapolis in 1980.
Oh, wow.
And just through luck, a girl who was in my same dorm walked by and saw my Prince record leaning against my bunk, and she came in and started talking to me. She told me later she'd never met a Prince fan outside of Minnesota, you know, who's from someplace else. And she and I really became best friends and embarked on this this fan journey that we were on. Eventually, I ended up dropping out. I was pretty serious about school, and of course, I went back later and finished my master's. But you know, I dropped out of college pretty much so that I could sort of ride this wave of exciting things that were happening in Minneapolis. So my friend Aylin had gone to high school with Prince. She'd been bused in from the southern part of the city, almost to the suburbs, to go to Central High School. So it was just great. Just a nice stroke of luck. We started going out and seeing Prince any and every chance we could get. We were pretty alert to his comings and goings from the city. You know, we'd see him at the, I saw him once at the gas station near my house. You know, that's the kind of, it was just that time and place. And then a couple years later, I got a job at First Avenue. So I started working there. I worked there for 4 years. And then because of that job, I had a chance to work on the film. And then I ended up being at about 25 dates on the Purple Rain tour as well.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just blind luck, really. Yeah. Really, really lucky. And then I had gone to all three nights of the reunion shows in September 2016 at First Avenue, the Revolution shows. Mm-hmm. And that's really how I started to conceive of the paper that I worked on for the conference. Was just this full spectrum from being an early fan right up to this moment that I wanted to describe from the Revolution reunion shows.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I don't think anybody would be offended if I said you have the most interesting backstory of the people I've talked to.
Well, it's just you know, it's an interesting thing, and of course, it's impacted my whole life.
Right.
You know, just that it was also right when I was becoming an adult. Mm-hmm. I came from South Dakota, so I was. You know, I grew up pretty rural South Dakota, so just moving to the city alone was an expansive learning experience. And then to kind of stumble into the world of Prince, just amazing. It's really neat to hear younger people talk about Prince now. It is very, very interesting to me to hear from people who, you know, encountered him later in life or didn't hear about him till Purple Rain, and
right.
To hear all these different, the whole Prince family thing, I'm sold. I'm very, 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 I was very excited to meet everybody in Manchester and just see all these different angles and really hear the heartfelt you know, analysis and celebration and everything from all corners. It's really been impressive to hear all that. I think of myself as somebody who knows a lot about Prince, And I've learned a lot through Manchester and the connections that I've made since then.
So I kind of want to talk about the conference, and I also kind of want to talk about like what Prince was wearing when you saw him at the gas station. I'm torn.
Yeah. You know, several people have asked me specifically, you know, about his high heels, and I don't think that I ever saw him not in high heels. You know, I would be hard pressed to remember exactly about the gas station, but
right.
Even when I've seen him in casual dress, like early mornings, on the Purple Rain set before he was in costume, you know, like I saw him in a brown sweater turtleneck once, you know, right before, you know, before, early in the morning at the shoots. But he was still wearing high-heeled boots, you know,
right.
Always looked, it was kind of a formality, you know, about Prince. He always looked put together, as far as I know him.
Yeah.
you know, even right before going into makeup, he's, you know, still had makeup on. There was something magical about Prince, even when he was kind of a person who came down to the club and, you know, hung around before he was super, super famous.
Right.
There was always something about Prince that was mesmerizing.
When was the first time you saw him in concert? You mentioned seeing him several times in the early 80s.
Yeah. I think the first time that I saw him in concert was at First Avenue in the timeline is hard for me. And this is another impressive thing about people who have been studying is that they really know the timeline.
Right.
Yeah. I first saw him at a show at First Avenue. But I think at that time I was still, you know, I hadn't sort of committed to Prince. You know, I had records. I saw him live. It really wasn't until Dirty Mind came out that I was really, truly blown away. Saw him at First Avenue, and then I remember rustling up, you know, half a dozen friends to go see him at the Controversy tour. And
okay.
That was out at the Met in Minneapolis, so, you know, more of like a stadium-type show. And that was when I thought, oh, this guy is going to be huge, huge. Just became super dedicated to kind of being fans, pushing him along, proselytizing for Prince, you know, telling everybody in the universe about this amazing kid from Minneapolis. You know, probably the thing that really stands out to me is the first time I really, this is before I worked at First Avenue, the first time that I really encountered him right next to me. And you know, he was just, there just was something mesmerizing about him. It's hard to put my finger on what it was. Chaz Smith was the last person who talked. He Skyped in at the end of the conference in Manchester. And he talked about how that was always the case, that people always treated him like he was special. And that it was exciting to be his cousin, you know, because he got to pick up some of that, you know, specialness by default, you know, his association with Prince, that even when he was young, he was that way. And my friend who went to high school with him has talked about that too, that, you know, there's just been something about him. So we went to, the first time I really encountered him, aside from seeing him live, was at the, I believe it was the first Minnesota Black Music Awards. And he, when he came through the crowd to accept his award, I think, you know, it was the Prom Center in St. Paul. I don't think there was a green room by the stage or anything like that. He actually walked through the crowd to accept an award. And right when he got to where my friend and I were standing, he kind of turned back to his entourage to say something and then spun back around to keep going forward. And as he spun, his like he had like on a long, you know, trench coat or tux jacket type thing. As he spun, his jacket brushed against my legs. I was, you know, hot summer day, you know, just, just a lot of beautiful memories like that, just to think. He was, you know, when I first encountered him, he was still a guy around town. People did treat him special, and there was something always about him as he was, you know, rising.
This is a new song. Probably won't be out for another year. Or six.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. It's must have been an interesting time to be in Minneapolis and to be kind of in Prince's orbit, because you know, up until 1999, he was certainly a local star, but he wasn't a huge kind of like inaccessible type of star that you would imagine him to be, like when you think about Prince now. It had to be interesting to see him sort of like on the rise.
Oh, it was just really amazing, because, you know, once you see Prince perform, well, I mean, his albums, of course, speak for themselves. And then once you see him perform, it's just such an incredible experience. But one of the neatest things about that era was being at the same shows as Prince. You know, to be able to look over in the crowd and see how he was reacting to a band on stage. It was just an amazing time to luck into, for sure.
I've heard that he used to like show up at a club where somebody was playing and then leave before the show was over, and kind of, you know, like half the audience would sort of come with him, like follow him out of the club. I've heard that was something that happened.
I don't remember that ever happening, but I think normally when I was encountering him in a situation like that, it was still part of the same scene. Like probably the person that I went to see the most, other than Prince during that time period, was Sue Ann Carwell.
Oh yeah,
I absolutely just loved her voice. She was a great performer, beautiful songs, and you know, she was kind of loosely attached. You know, it was probably more shows like that where Prince was kind of part of the situation, not an anonymous person in the crowd watching.
Interesting. Yeah. So one more thing about the 80s and then we should get back to the purpose of the discussion. I was just curious what you did on the Purple Rain tour, if you could speak a little bit to that.
I was just a hanger on. So my boyfriend at the time also worked at First Avenue, and we had both worked at, you know, they closed the club for a few weeks So we kind of got first crack at the job interviews so that we wouldn't be unemployed during that time. And we both got security jobs on the film. And then he subsequently got hired for security for the tour as well. So I would just go hang around with him from time to time on the tour. I did the whole West Coast. I saw the Chicago shows. I drove helped drive a Prince van down to Texas overnight one night. Just crazy things like that.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
My name is Prince, and I've come to play with you.
And I mean, so at that time, you know, you had kind of, you'd been in the Minneapolis scene, and now you were sort of here at this moment when things were getting kind of crazy. So I'm sure that was also an interesting experience.
It was interesting. And on a certain level, just exactly what we expected of Prince. We felt strongly that it was just a matter of time until he made it all the way out of Minneapolis and really got huge. There was still, Billboard still had such a thing as the black charts.
Right.
At that time. And, you know, that was, we always had our fingers crossed for him to cross over. It was really literal back then.
Right.
That the black charts were this kind of separate thing. And of course, you know, it's obvious looking back that he was deserving of being on the pop charts. Not relegated. So we were always just pulling for that. And so when it happened, I wouldn't say it was a surprise when he really became a rock star. It was very satisfying. You know, it sounds weird to say maybe, but I just felt so proud of him, you know, cause you see, you know, following him in that early 80s period, I was just, it was just amazing that he really made it. And just the gumption of it, what kind of idea is it to, you know, kind of let somebody who just graduated film school write a movie and direct it and be sure to shoot it, you know, when it's sub-zero in Minneapolis.
Right.
It's just a nutty idea. And, you know, I felt anxious about the quality of the film when I wrote the screenplay, and I talk a little bit about it in my paper too, because of course working security, I picked up a screenplay and read the whole thing. And you know, I was also studying literature and things in college. It seemed cheesy to me. I was really worried about Prince at first. You know, is this really gonna, are people gonna go for this?
Right.
But of course it's not about the screenplay. That's, you know, The Magic of Purple Rain is all about Prince and the Revolution and the other acts that were related to him.
Yeah, I think that's really what makes the movie hold up is there's the performance scenes, of course, which are, I mean, it sounds weird to say that it's some of the best like concert film that I've seen, since obviously he wasn't, you know, he was lip syncing, but it's just like even lip syncing, the performances are so magnetic that even seeing it, you know, I didn't even see it in the theater the first time I saw the movie. It was like, it was just incredible. And, and then also just, and I mean, obviously you would know better than me whether it's actually verisimilitude of that scene, but it feels very real and it feels sort of lived in, and it feels like the people who are on screen were actually there. You know, partly because nobody is really that great an actor, but also partly because I think the movie just does a good job of capturing like the feeling, I guess, of that kind of local community.
Yes, and I think that's what is captured, is the feeling. And, you know, people who loved Prince in 1983 didn't just love Prince a little. People really love Prince, and I think that comes across even in some of the extras that are in the film. I mean, to be there and, you know, get up and be an extra for these long days, It wasn't, people didn't do it for the money. There was just this swell of really love for Prince and this belief that he was deserving. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, at least some of the footage, he is also singing mm-hmm. along with the track. So I don't know how much difference that makes, but it seems like that's part of it too, is that he's not strictly lip syncing in the sense that he's not making any noise, that he was for the crowd, and the love of the crowd is real. Mm. That swaying that happens during Purple Rain in the film, I believe was not scripted, that was a spontaneous thing that the extras did.
Wow.
You know, it wasn't really a real concert, but it really captured so many things about what a real concert would be like.
Yeah, I believe that, and I totally believe that he would. It almost seems like he would have had to be actually singing for uh-huh. the performance to be so, you know, sort of hypnotizing, really.
Right, and just the physicality of his performance.
Right,
and just amazing. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, really an incredible time.
To what degree was the crowd like? It's so stylized, you know, the way they look. It's very like new romantic. Was that uh-huh. for the film, or was that actually what the scene looked like?
No, that was definitely for the film. Mm. And I think this is the thing about First Avenue, you know, that the really amazing thing about First Avenue is that it was every style of music. It was right. every kind of person. It wasn't by accident that every type of person felt welcome there, right? Mm. That was a deliberate strategy by the music booker and the team, was to have it really be a music place, not a certain type of person place. Mm. And so, you know, well, even if you looked at the footage that surfaced from the 83 show.
Ah, yeah.
You know, if you look at how people are dressed there, you know, we were dressed for summer, just cotton shorts, and you know, that was Minneapolis. It's right. just a little sleepy Midwestern city, you yeah. know, and really all that, you know, all the costuming and people wearing lace and things like that. That was a product of the film Purple Rain. That was not the scene.
I've always wondered that, because yeah. that's one of my favorite parts. Whenever I watch Purple Rain, like, the crowd shots are some of my favorite parts, but it definitely does feel very like could any actual, you know, small town music scene be that like manicured and cool, you know, like no. And especially where everybody's doing the synchronized dance in the scene with
right.
I think it's Modern uh-huh. Air, like that part just yeah. cracks me up.
Yeah, yeah, so great. No, it was definitely a movie, and hired extras, and many more people tried to be extras than were oh, yeah. hired. You know, it was for Minneapolis, of course, a pretty big deal, just the cattle call to begin with.
Right.
But no, I would say, you know, there the First Avenue crowd was a stylish crowd.
Right.
At in part. But it was just so diverse because you had sort of Black Minneapolis and, you know, a little bit of that time zoot suit thing was going on. It was also a time of punk and, you know, Mohawks and all of that stuff. Hip hop was teeny tiny brand new kind of to the Midwest at that time. And that was reflected in fashion. And First Avenue also had, you know, breakdance contests, and First Avenue had drag shows and WWF style wrestling, comedy nights. You know, First Avenue was a whole bunch of things. And Prince was, he was a big slice of it, but by no means was Prince First Avenue.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I might have to talk to you at some other point about this stuff, because I do want to talk about the conference, but like, I also really want to talk about Purple Rain. So let's talk about the conference. And I imagine that what, at least when we talk about your paper, it'll sort of feed back into Purple Rain. You talked a little bit about your general impressions, and you talked about seeing Charles Smith speak. What were some of the panels that sort of stuck out to you that you especially enjoyed?
Well, all the panels that I saw had something fantastic about them. I really enjoyed the whole conference. The vibe was just beautiful. It was, you know, it kind of had a surprisingly good kind of family feeling from the beginning. It wasn't really like a normal academic conference. I absolutely loved it. The other panelists during my slot were fantastic. Joy Ellison talked about the transgender history in Minneapolis. And that was amazing to see. You know, she had, you know, she focused on kind of the, you know, politics, fashion, and graffiti and iconography, that you can kind of see how, you know, this toying with the male-female symbol, you know, there's no way to know if Prince was exposed to that, but you can kind of see it as part of this whole progression and sort of mid-century, you know, underground fashion. It was really fantastic. And then Jane Jones was the other person on my panel. And, you know, she did a great job. It was so fun and kind of extravagant and philosophy and science-ish, you know. So great. I think probably the paper that really struck me the most was Camilla Cummings from DePaul did a paper on Prince's leadership. To me, that is just such an interesting part of it, because that's something that I really connect to. You know, I think looking back at my young self, what I was learning, I wasn't learning how to be like Prince. You know, his message that I took out of that era was be yourself, get going, do your thing, you know, and that's much more how I think about Prince. Not that he was trying to get people to be like him, but that he just was such an interesting model for how to conduct your life. And so she had it, you know, she had his leadership broken up into different categories, and just talked about his impact on others. I really loved that panel a lot. When he first passed, I have a friend who does, I think he has the longest running hip hop show in the region here. And he's a huge Prince fan. I knew that he would want to do something on his Friday show. So the first thing I thought about texting him was when I was on the Purple Rain tour, Prince was, you know, he's always given money away to things that he was interested in and always been pretty quiet about it. He gave a lot of money to Marva Collins School in Chicago. And I hadn't thought of becoming an educator yet, but I knew about Marva Collins from 60 Minutes and, you know, I was a high school debater also. So, you know, I just read a lot in general about America and current events. And I got to visit Marva Collins School with a little Prince entourage. And, you know, that was one of the first things that popped into my head, that, you know, he's been leaning into leadership for a long time, that he has made conscious choices about what's important to put into the world. You know, even back in those days, as soon as he had a little bit of, you know, money and fame. So that was really neat.
Yeah.
And then, and that whole panel was great too. You know, other stuff about his political consciousness, and that, I don't know if anybody's talked to you about that mixtape project, but there was,
yes,
a really neat, yeah, that was really cool too. And then another thing that I was just so fascinated with, and I wish it had been an hour instead of 20 minutes, was Rashad Shabazz.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, he's a geographer, and I'm probably not going to get it all right on what geography is, but, you know, as a field, but he was looking at how Prince's family coming up from the South, as part of the Great Migration, you know, leaving Jim Crow for, hopefully better opportunities in the North. All of his four grandparents are from Louisiana.
Right.
And his talk about how it was a very particular place and time that was able to produce Prince. And, you know, I think one important thing to remember about that is it wasn't just Prince. He didn't rise in isolation. that he was part of a whole scene of super talented African-American Minneapolis people.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, he rose to the top of that. But he wasn't alone, and he wasn't unsupported, and he wasn't, you know, I think that the movie Purple Rain, you know, kind of errs on the side of showing him as this isolated, alone person who just makes it all on his own. And
right,
of course, that wasn't the reality. And it was really neat to hear this geographer talk about, you know, that his family is directly part of this migration from South to North that wasn't, you know, Jim Crow is pretty serious,
yeah,
part of our history, and you can see why people would leave that behind. It's interesting that, you know, somebody's looking into sort of the values and the way that he would have been raised and the circumstance of that in particular, looking at this, specifically looking at his family as an African-American family,
right,
moving North.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's important work. You know, a lot of people that I've talked to in the course of recording these podcasts, a recurring theme has been that there needs to be Black scholars are playing a really important role in this sort of,
yes,
field of scholarship about Prince.
Yes.
In some cases, it's, you know, sort of reclaiming him from kind of a whitewashed legacy. And then I also think making, you know, even less sort of, less assertive than that, it's even making connections that I think would not necessarily be made by a white scholar or a scholar who's not conversant with African American history. It is interesting to look at his musical development in this context of the Great Migration that really shaped,
uh-huh,
all African American music.
Uh-huh.
Most people who migrated from Louisiana didn't end up in Minneapolis, which is part of what,
uh-huh,
makes it unique. But,
uh-huh,
but there are continuities there that I think are important, when, especially when you look at how his music connects to, you know, jazz and blues and these traditions that, you know, pre-existed before Prince.
Yes, and Minneapolis was still a segregated town, even though it wasn't in the South. So,
right,
you know, if you think about his father's musical ambitions, that was taking place by and large in a more segregated Minneapolis than what Prince encountered.
Right, right.
So I think that is it's such an important history to be told. And I think it's not an obvious history, you know, unless you're really looking into it, or, you know, or you were from Minneapolis.
Yeah.
No, you know, if you lived in Minneapolis in the early 80s, there's no question that Prince was black. You know, right. we understood the, am I black or white? Am I straight or gay? You know, we understood the lyrics to be provocative song lyrics. Mm. There was no actual question as to whether he was black or white.
Right.
Probably the panel that influenced me, well, there was a panel I did not attend, but I've probably talked about this panel with more people than any of the panels that I did attend. The panel, and I'm not the person to ask about the panel. I can only describe my conversations after. But this idea that Prince somehow transcended race and that we have to guard against this idea that somehow because he was a big superstar, somehow blackness wasn't enough to contain that and that he somehow transcended blackness. I'm so glad that those voices were there.
Yeah.
And I think that, or at least from my perspective, that panel, the ripples that have gone out from that panel are strong. And I think, you know, I've never thought of Prince as someone who transcended race. I mean, I think we say he's transcendent in the sense that he was just a unique person.
Right.
And any way you want to look at Prince, he is pretty unique. But we wouldn't want to have any confusion about where he came from and who he was.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, the way you put it is, even though it wasn't, your paper, I think the way you put it is interesting and useful, because it is kind of this idea that like it's possible to outgrow blackness or to be too big for blackness. And that's it's a strange idea when you think about it in that way, you know, because if anything, he sort of expanded the public perceptions of what one was able to do within that racial category, which is a very different thing than transcending that category.
Right. And so maybe that's more appropriately what he transcended was small views of blackness, stereotypes of what it meant to be black or what it means to be black. I mean, he certainly pushed through preconceptions about a lot of things. He was a unique individual. But there's certainly nothing about being African American that would guard against uniqueness.
Right.
I wish I had been at that panel. One of the things about the conference, one of your other guests said it was like being at a festival.
Right.
Right. You have to choose which stage you're going to go to in a time slot. And that was hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. There were a lot of great things. So sorry I missed it. But, you know, I've discussed it with a lot of people. And I'm just super happy that we had those voices there, and the diversity of the conference really to me was pretty amazing. One of the other things I really loved was I am going to try to find the name. There was a guy who he was like a musicologist who looked way into Prince's guitar style. Michael Ugrich. I might not be saying his name correctly. And like, for instance, he called our attention to I believe it was the Rolling Stone Top 100 Guitar Players. Prince was number, I think, 32 or 33.
Yeah.
Joey Ramone was number 28.
Yeah.
It just kind of made no sense. It was really neat to see this, somebody who's specifically looking at, he specifically looked, for instance, at Computer Blue, you know, the musical notation of Prince's solo in that song, and really could describe in this you know, really nitty gritty. What was so great about that song? From a musical standpoint, just this whole range that we saw from the big picture, kind of meta political things like that, and then just down to the nitty gritty of, you know, how did he play those notes?
Right.
And what does that mean? What does his extraordinary talent down to the minutiae mean? It was just a really, really broad spectrum. There was an acting coach who talked about, you know, the impact of what taking acting classes does for you as a performer and how he could see that in that sudden expansiveness that we got in Purple Rain.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, it was so interesting. And just this idea that he talked about, you know, in improv, the thing where you say yes to everything, you know, it's yes, you move on. And that's what the band was experiencing together right before, you know, they went to film and before they, you know, undertook the Purple Rain tour. The conference was fantastic. There will be another one in Minneapolis in April. And I'm pretty hopeful about that one too.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. You would think that eventually when the field is just one person's body of work, that we would run out of, you know, things to say. Obviously that's not the case, because there have been, you know, annual conferences about Shakespeare and Dickens and all kinds of people for, right, you know, centuries. But it's constantly amazing to me how, you know, you can spend so much time listening to Prince or thinking about Prince, and there's still more to discover. Like, you know, every person I talk to has some kind of different perspective that I haven't considered yet. And I think that, I mean, you know, most of the people I talk to are fairly obsessed fans, which is certainly part of it. But I think there's also just this kind of intensity couldn't exist without a richness to the artistry, you know, and to even just who he was as a person.
Yes, there is just so much there. And part of it is, you know, Prince has this funny paradox of being on one hand so mysterious and kind of at the other end of the continuum. He seems to just leave it all on the stage, say anything, do anything. And yet, you know, you always get a sense of there's the private side of it too, that definitely his performance is, you know, a persona. And I think that when he was alive, people were very hesitant to talk about him and to talk about private stories and things. I don't know if you saw Van Jones on CNN right after Prince died. You know, talking about you know, all of his work behind the scenes. And you know, I mean, Van Jones was never going to talk about that
kind
of stuff while Prince was alive. You know, we just immediately started to get different points of view, new information, things that were happening behind the scenes for Prince privately. So I think that it's going to last, the Prince scholarship.
There's
so much to do. And we are already at the place where many of the people who were first involved with Prince in those early years are elderly.
Right.
You know, I am really hoping to see some scholarship around that, and talking to people who were privy to the inside Prince world in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're completely right. It's like there's now sort of an imperative for oral history, because you know, I mean, a lot of these people have spoken to biographers or spoken to music journalists and all of that stuff. But you know, I think that there are things that I would want to ask, or that other people now would want to ask, that maybe they would not have considered asking before, or maybe the people being interviewed wouldn't have been at liberty to say. So I definitely think that there's a need for that.
And also the whole landscape has shifted now. You know, I think when Prince was alive, it was still so exciting to see what he did next. Mm. You know, even this week, you know, I sure wish Prince were around to say something about what happened in Virginia.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think the main thing that's shifted is that now this is all we have. What we have of Prince is that's all that we're ever going to have. Mm,
yeah.
So things have changed. I think that the academic world could really have a place in his legacy, and you know, an important place that cuts to the bone of what it really is. One of the speakers at the conference called for a Prince epistemology. You know, and I think that that's a neat idea to think about. If we were to build an academic discipline from scratch, how would we want it to be? And do we want it to be like other academic disciplines? Or are there things based on Prince's leadership that we'd like to see happen different in this field of study? You know, one of the things I really noticed at the conference was the lack of competitiveness, or you know, you didn't get the sense that people were guarded at all. People are really sharing their ideas right now. It's really a fantastic time. I hope we build a real nice body of information around Prince.
Yeah. So to that end, that's a good transition into your specific paper, which I'm really eager to hear about.
This song is called Computer Blue.
Yeah, well, it's about this moment in Computer Blue where Wendy gets down on her knees in front of Prince. And again, you know, I wouldn't have thought of writing about that if I hadn't been at the Revolution reunion shows in 2016. That really the trigger for the paper was that show. So I'd been at the 8383 show, and there was probably everybody seen the Purple Rain video from that night. But right after he died, there was on YouTube, you know, there was this whole film that was all or most of the show that night. And I can see myself in that footage. I'm standing right in front of Wendy in the crowd.
Oh.
I mean, it was just amazing to see, because of course that night has had, you know, I've seen Prince many, many times, but that night had particular significance just because of its the way that it melded into the movie and the, you know, sort of that there was just this sort of peak excitement in the Prince underworld kind of right then, you know, before the movie. And that was Wendy's first night. It was really, really exciting to have another female in the band. And, you know, I think 1983, you have to remember, there weren't that many women guitar players then.
Oh, yeah.
That it was just so great to see her. And, you know, she was a little bit younger than me. I think I felt kind of protective of her. I didn't like that moment in the show.
Right.
Of course, this amazing show, and I'm taking anything away from how much I loved it. But in the moment, to see this new girl on the job, she's a musician in her own right. She clearly wasn't coming through the kind of Vanity Six door.
Right.
You know, she was a different thing, and I did have this sinking feeling, like just a passing moment. You know, where I felt disappointed in Prince, because we also understood that, you know, Prince was in charge.
Right.
You know, we thought of as someone who, you know, hired people to play what he said to play. We didn't, we never thought, oh, a band. you know, they are a band. I mean, they still are. But, you know, my perception of it at the time was that it wasn't her idea.
Right.
Right. And I've, you know, Magnoli talks about in the in the 20th anniversary of Purple Rain, in the director's discussion, he says that Wendy was squeamish about that, you know, and I was too. Well, that continued on, you know, it became, you know, that was a prominent point in Purple Rain, the film. And I talked a little bit about that in the paper too. The stage direction for that was pretty extreme. You know, the stage direction for that moment is that Prince is going down on himself. That's the idea of it. That is a kind of a wild idea. I mean, it's kind of you know, it just like twists and overlaps in ways that you can't quite understand to have this female, you know, be down on her knees. You know, also just kind of the wrinkle that she's a lesbian, which I feel like we knew at the time. I'm not sure if that was common knowledge out in the world or not. You know, it was play acting, but it was kind of over the top, maybe. Was in the script, it's meant to be that, right? So this is how, you know, Prince is going to be redeemed, is he's going to go too far and then he's going to be redeemed. And, and that's a nice movie plot line. And then it continued in the live show too. It was a little bit more elaborate in the live show. You know, you got the voiceover of, you know, Wendy's voice beaming in, almost like the voice of God, sort of giving Prince the what for. But she's still doing the posture. You know, she's, the gesture is still part of the show. And I never loved it. You know, I sort of came to understand it as a plot point in the movie that was, you know, perhaps driven by Al Magnoli. And then when the shows happened in September, they had hired an extra guitar player who came in, and on the second night of those shows, he appeared, surprised everyone by getting down on his knees in front of Wendy during that theater too. And it was just, I mean, those shows were, it was a celebration. It was like a wake. Everyone was so sad. You know, the band cried. People, everyone cried. There were just so many emotions happening. But when that happened, you know, there was just like this joyous, raucous, like yelling, laughing, you know, for me, because I remembered this first moment so specifically from 1983. I just thought it was just a great reversal. I just thought it was fantastic. And, you know, the crowd really reacted to it. It just, I don't know, it kind of brought it full circle and took the sting out of it. And it just took on a completely different meaning. You know, so in my mind, you know, for a man to take a knee, it sort of desexualizes it. And makes it somehow more about, you know, giving credit where credit is due, or honor, fidelity, something more along those lines. But it just doesn't have all the same connotations of a woman getting on her knees in front of a man.
Right.
Particularly a man playing guitar.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's just the like classic phallic. Yeah.
Yes. It's just like doubly there.
Right.
So it was really that strange closure that happened in 2016 about this little moment that prompted the paper.
Yeah.
And then it was really fun to look into that moment and, you know, see what other commentary had been made about it, or what other people thought about it.
It is such a, as soon as I heard that this was what you wrote about, I was like, okay, I need to talk to Carmen, because this is such a, that scene is so, there's just so much going on, which you've spoken to. And I never know entirely how to read it, you know, and part of me is questioning, you know, like why doesn't this rub me as much the wrong way as it would if, like, you know, Ted Nugent or like Ace Frehley from Kiss had done it. You know what I mean? But then part of me is also like it certainly feels more macho than and more sort of sexually conventional than a lot of Prince's stage presence at the time was. But then on the other hand, there's the queerness that you mentioned, Wendy's queerness, and then the fact that this gesture was, you know, pretty much lifted directly from David Bowie and Mick Ronson, who used to do that as a, you know, an inherently queer onstage act. Right. There's just so much. It's just an incredibly like complex and it's an overloaded signifier. You know what I mean? It means almost too much at the same time.
Yes, and so for anyone who wants to pick a meaning, that's going to be a fool's errand, I think. You know, it's very hard to see just one thing in there. And I think, you know, what disturbed me in the moment on 8383 was that it was conventional. There was nothing bold about it. It seemed like a little regression, right? Yeah. I couldn't understand it in the context of a Prince show where, you know, normally he's doing whatever's going on with the sexual boundary breaking. And, you know, and I mean, you know, he and Gail Chapman were involved in, you know, they engaged in sexualized play on stage. But this posture seemed conventional. I think that's a good word for it, where it just didn't seem to live up to the standard that I have become accustomed to, that Prince is going to do something fresh every time you see him. There's new songs, new things are happening. He's a better dancer. You know, all of this stuff is going on. And that seemed it for me, it, in the moment, it fell flat. Now, understanding it as part of this larger, you know, the screenplay, which, of course, I wasn't privy to in August of 83, you know, it makes more sense in the screenplay, in the sense that Prince, the character in the film, is wildly out of touch with his emotions and and especially the women in his life. When that scene comes in the film, it's right after his father tells him, never get married.
Right.
You know, so it takes on more complexity in the context of the film, and I can appreciate it as that. When it first popped up, I just didn't care for it.
Right.
But I think this is always the thing. If you're a Prince fan, you might not love everything.
Yeah. Prince does. That's very true. Yeah. I think that whole scene is supposed to be, you know, shocking in the film, like Computer Blue and then Darling Nikki. And I don't, the movie doesn't entirely pull it off. It always struck me as a little, it feels a little forced that, you know, Apollonia runs out like in tears. It's always, and I've seen this, I've watched the movie with people who aren't as invested in the movie as me. And they're confused. They're usually confused by that scene. They're like, did she think it was about her? Like what was that? You know, they don't really pull it off, I think, but I get what they were going for. And, you know, Computer Blue is also, In the album version doesn't do it any favors, because like you mentioned in live shows and then now on the expanded Purple Rain, we hear this whole other movement to the song, which
the whole hallway speech.
Yeah. It's like the second half of this whole psychodrama. And it does contextualize that first half to an extent. So it's interesting that didn't make it onto the album. And I think that would have made things even a little more complex.
Poor lovely computer, it's time someone programmed you. It's time you learned love and lust. They both have four letters, but they're entirely different words. Thank you.
Right, and I mean, the song itself is just, you know, the song is a monster. It's such an amazing song, and I think the other thing that's revealed by that longer version is that you start to really get a sense of the involvement of Wendy and Lisa in its construction.
Right.
You know, it's not like, you know, as my first view of it was, where somehow Wendy is this hired hand that, you know, her job is to get down on her knees. You know, she was an important part of the song, the writing of the song, the recording of the song.
Yeah.
You know, it's even on the, in the stage shows of Purple Rain, the tour, you know, it's Wendy's voice that, and, you know, and I think the stuff that came on for the tour was pieces of that hallway speech excised for the live show, you know, but you got much more of Wendy. So even though she's still doing the same posture,
right,
she's also this voice of God in the hall.
Yeah, it sort of increases her agency, I guess you could say.
Uh-huh.
I do think there is when you mentioned the idea of, you know, it was Wendy's first night,
uh-huh,
and she was, you know, new to the group, and Prince definitely hired her. It's not like they formed a band together and we're on equal
right.
footing. There
sure.
is something interesting there. You know, you mentioned Gail Chapman, and I think it might have actually been Prince who wrote in his sort of the liner notes for his greatest hits collection that that Alan Leeds later adapted. I think he was talking about Head, and he wrote about how when Lisa joined the group, he used that almost as like a trial by fire for her. It was like, if you can do this, if you can handle singing these lyrics, then you can handle anything. And I wonder if there was a little bit of that in the Computer Blue, if he was kind of sort of deliberately throwing Wendy into this uncomfortable situation like that on her first night with the group.
Mm-hmm. And the performance of it is really different. So in the film, you know, she's fully facing Prince.
Mm.
On 8383, she sort of hit a mark behind Prince, got down on her knees, but she's still facing the audience.
Mm.
And then Prince comes over and stands next to her so that, you know, his side is to the audience. But it was fascinating to see that film because it wasn't exactly how I remembered it. I think my memory had sort of taken on the tone of what it was like in the film. And
that
actually on that night, she's still facing the audience and she's leaning kind of back to the left, seemingly as far as she can from Prince. Like, she's resisting the posture right. as she can within the posture.
Mm.
But this trial by fire idea, I mean, that makes sense, I think. You know, in the world of Prince.
Right.
You know, it seems like that could be... that could be a possibility.
And I guess the last thing I wanted to say was related to the Revolution shows. I saw them after, you know, the Paisley Park reunion on their tour when they came to the DC area.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, they didn't recreate the Computer Blue stagecraft. But I did think there were a couple of moments that I thought were interesting, where Wendy, as the front woman, sort of corrected some of the sexual politics. I remember in particular, you know, she's saying Raspberry Beret, and like the lines about, like, you know, I put her on the back of my bike, that whole part, it took on a different and I think in some ways more progressive kind of, you know, kind of meaning coming out of her mouth. So it's interesting to see how these things can shift just based on who's in control of the song.
Right. Yes. And, you know, I think his writing in general allowed for some of these possibilities, you know, like it's come up, you know, was Prince a feminist?
Right.
Well, he certainly didn't conform to, you know, if we were to have a good, solid, you know, women's studies definition of feminism and the actions you should probably take if you are one. He didn't conform to that.
Right.
But he opened up possibilities in the world. You know, I was, in particular, you know, this lyric, am I straight or gay? Hearing that as a young person in the early 80s, I had grown up in kind of an unusual situation where culturally I hadn't learned the gay prejudice. I really sort of became aware of gay prejudice, like how intense it was. Mm-hmm. You know, once I got out into the world a bit, and my friends and I absolutely loved that he wouldn't say that he was straight to avoid rumors that he was gay, that he kind of into this possibility that that everybody's equal. Even though we don't necessarily think of him as somebody who was out there politicking for gay rights, he allowed for these other possibilities. And, you know, I think that we shouldn't underestimate the influence that the revolution had on Prince. You know, that these were people that he hand selected at a time when he had a goal of becoming huge.
Right.
And each of them served a purpose for Prince, but also influenced Prince. And I think in particular, Wendy, she had a playfulness with Prince. She kind of was this new kid on the block. I think she had a playfulness and a relationship with him that really was special. On that, the night of 8/3/83, she got quite a bit more attention than other band members on that night. And the lighting at the time was so bad in First Avenue, and this is the other thing that's dramatically different, you know, between First Avenue the club and Purple Rain the movie,
right?
Is that, you know, actually, you know, it was a pretty new club at the time. Or, you know, had shifted to new owners,
right?
And you know, you can barely see Matt and Lisa. The lighting is so poor, you know, that even visually it's a little bit, you know, Prince and Wendy show. So, you know, it didn't seem like she was being demeaned all evening or anything like that. Just this odd posture that took me out of the show, I think is probably part of it. You know, it took me out of the magic of the show to be like, ah. Come on.
Right.
but, you know, she's an adult too, and worked out whatever she worked out with Prince to perform that posture. For me as a fan, it wasn't my favorite.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think there is a lot of interesting stuff in there of how can somebody who's cutting edge as Prince was in that moment in history to be doing such a conventional posture.
Right. And I still don't, even after, you know, this conversation, I still don't really have any answer. I think it's right. it really is just like an inscrutable moment. Or maybe I'm making it inscrutable. Maybe, you know, maybe it literally is just like I want to do like a cock rock posture, you know, this is my like arena rock moment. I don't know. With Prince, I feel compelled to make it more complicated than that.
Right. Maybe it was something like that, or maybe it was completely an invention of Al Magnoli,
right,
for the purposes of the screenplay, and something that they all went along with.
Mm.
You know, I don't feel any certainty about that, and certainly the first time that they performed this posture in public, neither one of them really seemed in the game of it. You know, looking back at the footage of it, it seems a little bit perfunctory.
That is interesting.
Yeah, but if it really was strictly choreography for the film that they were rehearsing, as you know, if you watch that bootleg footage, you can see a lot of choreography that's soon to be in Purple Rain. You know, even the spins that he does during Computer Blue that night, you know, that's choreography that carries over. Mm-hmm. So maybe it was always Al Magnoli. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, there's, it's tough to like put a cap on that conversation. Yeah, thank you again so much for coming on and talking to me. You know, I say this to everybody. I wish I could have been at the conference, but this is like the next best thing. It really is. It's a lot of fun to talk to everybody about their papers and. There's just so many great ideas.
I hope they do it again in Manchester.
Mm.
But I think, you know, as a field, I'm very much looking forward to seeing some of the same people again and see what people have been working on. It's for all the sadness of Prince being gone, which still is not quite believable.
Right.
The conference really just kind of, you know, revealed this this hopefulness that endures about Prince and his legacy and the influence that he had on music and culture and the way that we think about ourselves and. You know, individual people and identity and his influence is, even though it's sad, it is so sad. It's almost beyond belief that he's gone.
Mm.
His influence feels like something super positive, but with depth.
Yeah.
You know, it was a little like, you know, it's a hard thing. It's a little funny to say, oh, I'm going to a Prince conference.
Right.
And, you know, it sounds like it's not going to be serious, kind of.
Right.
and I would say that it was serious.
Mm.
That it had all the good academic things you'd hope for from a conference. People working from their heart, yes. Mm. But also, you know, bringing a kind of rigor to it to really, you know, investigate and get to the bottom of things and express things as well as possible. And really look at all facets of, you know, Prince contains multitudes. There's so much there, and there is a kind of joy in it, and a kind of joy in hearing all these fantastic points of view on somebody like Prince. And I still feel kind of proud of him, you know, in the sense that he's made it all this way from the kid I saw at the gas station.
Mm. Yeah.
And the other thing that I do want to say about the conference is not everybody was an academic.
Right.
that there were people not associated with colleges or universities who also came, and, you know, good on them for applying, and good on, you know, Kirsten and the organizers to really take a range of background and experience, because from what I can tell, all the voices were so important at this conference, no matter where the project was coming from.
Right. Yeah. I mean, some of the most interesting conversations I've had after this conference have been with people who were not, you know, trained academics. And that actually, that does make me think about, you know, you mentioned like what makes Prince scholarship different than other disciplines. And that does, it does feel like that, at least at this stage, there's a genuine interdisciplinarity to it. Yeah. And there's a genuine, sort of democracy to it. I hope that stays, because I think that really makes it vibrant and exciting. And, you know, frankly, like I used to be an academic or I was trying to be an academic, and I feel like my academic career is actually healthier a little bit, like now, you know, I'm going to be in the collected volume on Prince of the Minneapolis Sound that's coming out. And I never had an essay published in a collection when I was pursuing my PhD. So like, right. this is working out great for me. Like,
mm-hmm. Well, I think that feeling of kind of democracy is really important. I hope we don't lose that. I hope that we do really, you know, think about what we'd like the discipline to be in, and, you know, in the spirit of Prince, make that happen and not let it just be another academic thing where it starts to close off outsiders to the academic world. I mean, I feel like I've definitely met people who didn't go to college but have a master's in Prince.
Right.
You know, I've learned a lot from people who are focusing on things that I haven't focused on, you know, because I have this unique lane that I came through where, it, you know, it really was about being an early fan. But to hear people talk about, you know, some of his later work that I'm not as familiar with, it seems really, really important. And I hope that we don't get too concerned about what lane that's coming through, because there are a lot of interesting people with a lot of interesting things to say right now.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. Again, thank you so much to Carmen for coming on and talking to me. I'm sure we'll have her on again in the future. And thank you so much for listening. Once again, the usual spiel. You can find the podcast on any of the major services. If you want to subscribe, we are producing content a lot more regularly than we used to be. I can't promise I'm going to keep it up forever, but for right now, I'm pretty happy with the amount that I've been putting out. And of course, you can check out the blog Dance Music Sex Romance at princesongs.org. And thank you one more time. Thank you so much for listening. Sexual curve. Tell me, do you feel it too?